It is good to be with you this morning. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to worship with you in this beautiful, light-filled sanctuary. But truth be told, the real gift of your invitation is that you provided me an opportunity to visit with your new senior minister. The Reverend Liz Lerner-McClay is a dear friend of mine. For several years, we served on the Center Committee of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association. The Center Committee is the committee charged with overseeing the continuing education of all Unitarian Universalist ministers. And while I served on it with Liz, I saw her do something that is one of the most difficult things of all to do: minister to other ministers. We clergy, after all, are an incredibly prickly bunch and are far too often prone to our own inward turnings. Liz is one of those rare colleagues who pushes us to move beyond our private selves and our inward focus. She constantly reminds us that though religion may be a private matter, it is something that we do in public, and that Unitarian Universalism has an important role to play in making the world a better place. So I thank you not just for the opportunity to worship in this gorgeous sanctuary, but also to visit with a dear friend. My sermon this morning is about how we come to know the self. The self that we will be considering is not individual. It is social. The same is true of whatever path of salvation or we might take towards that which we sometimes call salvation, enlightenment, divine knowledge, or nirvana. This path is not one that we travel as individuals. It is one we discover together. The Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh approaches this point when he suggests that we meditate upon the nature of a sheet of paper. Now, it seems obvious to claim that paper comes from trees that grow in forests. Thich Nhat Hanh encourages us to look deeper. If we look into this sheet of paper, we can see the sunshine in it. If the sunshine is not there, the forest cannot grow. In fact, nothing can grow. Even we cannot grow without sunshine. And so we know that sunshine is in the piece of paper. And if we continue to look, we can see the logger who cut the trees and brought them to the paper mill. And then if we look deeper still, we see the logger's wheat. We know the logger cannot exist without his daily bread. And therefore, the wheat that became his bread is in the sheet of paper too. And so are the logger's father and mother. And when we open ourselves to look in this way, we see that with all of these things, the paper cannot exist. The sheet of paper does not exist by itself. The same is true for each of us. We have been constituted by our relations with our families, our communities, our society, and all that is on this muddy blue planet we call Earth. As the poet Wieslawa Szymborska confessed, "I owe a lot to those I do not love." We are even shaped by strangers. Such a claim runs counter to American culture and indeed portions of our own Unitarian Universalist tradition. Many of us take our principle of commitment to a free and responsible search for truth and meaning to be an individual quest. In doing so, we might invoke historic figures dear to our tradition, like Ralph Waldo Emerson, or Henry David Thoreau, or Margaret Fuller. Just this past year, we celebrated Thoreau's 200th anniversary. He was raised a Unitarian in our congregation out in Concord. When he resigned his membership at the tender age of 23, he sent the clerk a simple note: I do not wish to be considered a member of First Parish in this town. Thoreau did not give an explicit reason. His famous individualism suggests that he might have held a sentiment about the congregation similar to that expressed by the comedian Groucho Marx. Groucho once wrote, "Please accept my resignation. I don't care to belong to any club that will have me as a member." Yet, against his objections, we Unitarian Universalists have taken Thoreau as a member. In a recent article in the UU World, Howard Dana, the current minister in Concord, makes the claim, "Modern-day Unitarian Universalism was in many ways started by Thoreau and Emerson." Now, I will admit that my own historical and theological sensibilities make me somewhat disinclined to agree with my colleague. Nonetheless, there is substantive truth to the idea that Thoreau is a major figure within our tradition. His words are frequently invoked from Unitarian Universalist pulpits. There are numerous religious education curriculum that focus on his texts and philosophy. Meditation manuals are drawn from his writings. Ministerial students study him in seminary. There is even a congregation named after him in Texas. I will even admit to citing Thoreau's tangential connection to our history when confronted by the perplexed who have never heard of Unitarian Universalism before. When many of us think of Thoreau, we think of the archetypal individual. If I say his name, perhaps you recall the opening paragraph of his classic Walden. "When I wrote the following pages, I lived alone in the woods, a mile from any neighbor, and a house which I myself had built on the shore of Walden Pond, and Concord, Massachusetts, and earned my living by my hands only. I lived there 2 years and 2 months. At present, I am a sojourner in civilized life again. I lived alone in the woods, a mile from any neighbor, in a house which I had built myself." Such words express the autonomy of the individual. They imply that the self we are considering in worship is an individual. And how easy is it to center on this perception? What is more individual than the self? The sense of I, me, the one who is speaking from the pulpit appears as a singular perception. I suspect the same is true of the you who is sitting in the aged wooden pews. This pulpit and those pews were carved hundreds of years ago when this sanctuary was built. Yet, if you run your hands across the smooth grain, I imagine it is you and you alone who will experience the tactile sensation of finger against smooth varnish. Certainly, as far as I can perceive, the hand I place now upon these cushions is mine and mine alone. I am unaware of anyone else perceiving the precise contact I have against them. And yet, we owe to others that we have this sanctuary, that we can gather to worship, that we can gaze distractedly out of the clear glass windows as the sermon progresses, that we can lean on the cushions of the pews, that we have language at all to describe these experiences and objects. I owe a lot to those I do not love. We are social creatures. The self that each of us perceives from has been constructed socially. Think for a moment about the very categories we use to describe ourselves and each other. Gender, race, class, citizenship. Each of these is a social construct, not a natural category. Male and female, transgender gender nonconforming, black, white, Asian, Latinx, indigenous, rich, poor, United States citizen, or beloved undocumented sibling. These labels we give each other do not exist outside of human language. I suspect that many, if not most of us, use all of these categories when we imagine ourselves. I know I do. Lately, I've been applying for a lot of jobs, and when I apply for jobs, I have to fill out forms that require me to check off various boxes: white, male, non-Hispanic. And I know that when many people see me, they see white, male, heteronormative. These categories have formed many of the experiences and opportunities I have had throughout my life. And these opportunities and experiences have in turn shaped my sense of self, my understanding of the I that is speaking now and perceiving before you. One of my teachers, the folk singer, anarchist, and Unitarian Universalist Bruce Utah Phillips, used to like to share words from his own teacher, a member of the Catholic Worker Pacifist Movement named Ammon Hennessy. When Bruce was a young man, much younger than I am now, he told Ammon he wanted to be a pacifist. Ammon said to him, "You came into this world armed to the teeth, with an arsenal of weapons, weapons of privilege, economic privilege, sexual privilege, racial privilege. You want to be a pacifist? You're not going to have to just give up guns and knives and clubs and hard and angry words. You're going to have to lay down the weapons of privilege and go into the world completely disarmed." When I think about Ammon's words, I realize how little of who I am can truly be attributed to my own actions and choices, and how much I have benefited from all of the privileges of economic and racial caste that I was born into. What about you? How much of who you are has been shaped by the perceptions and choices of others? My own ability to achieve an education, to have the self-discipline to work hard, to appreciate art, to love literature. I owe a lot to those I do not love. This self we have is a social creation, and so its salvation must be social as well. Now, when I use the word salvation, I'm not explicitly invoking the Christian tradition or bringing forth the Buddhist idea of nirvana, extinction of the self and escape from suffering. Instead, I'm thinking about the philosopher Josiah Royce. He rendered salvation as the idea that there is some end or aim of human life which is more important than all other aims. Suggested that we are always in great danger of missing this highest aim, and in doing so, we might render our lives a senseless failure by virtue of coming short of this goal. We might simply put Royce's thought differently by saying salvation suggests that there is a purpose to life and that we are ever in danger of missing it. So much of religion is devoted in one fashion or another to this idea. And so many religious traditions suggest that they and they alone have the key to this path, which is a path for the individual to achieve. The majority of Christian theologians, mystics, and religious leaders encourage us to find our salvation through the development of a personal relationship with Jesus Christ and with God. The bulk of Buddhist thought centers upon the achievement of individual enlightenment. Our own dear Thoreau lived alone in the woods, a mile from any neighbor, in a house which I had built myself. But if the self is social, as I have been suggesting, then its salvation must be social as well. As the poet Audre Lorde observed, "Without community, there is no liberation. Only the most vulnerable and temporary armistice between an individual and her oppression." The great end of human life, whatever it may be, is something that we will either fail to achieve together or achieve together. We are going to deconstruct or change or alter all of the categories that define and, yes, oppress us and limit us, the categories that brought some of us armed to the teeth into this world. Then that is something we must do together. This change, this deconstruction, is part of our path to communal salvation. It does not lie through the obliteration of our differences or the deconstruction of our individual selves, for while the self is constructed socially, it is nonetheless something that I experience, and I imagine you experience, as real as well. No other hand but mine now rests upon this velvet. No other back but yours rests upon that pew. Lord advises us, community does not mean the shedding of our differences, nor the pathetic pretenses that those differences do not exist. I trust that your experience is your own, just as my experience is my own. The very problem with so many narratives of individual salvation is that they suggest that there is only one path to ultimate truth, whatever it may be, and that particular religious traditions own that path. Salvation is to be found through Jesus. Nirvana comes through meditation. Thoreau suggested that self-reliance is the key. So many religions offer us the one true scripture. There are many paths, but we must figure out how to navigate them together. Salvation, our highest purpose, is something that we either achieve together or we will perish together as a species like fools. Has this not been the tumultuous story of the news of the last year? Is that not the story of the news of all the years of our lives? That we must learn to respect our differences while building a world and a community that liberates us all? In the end, the major message of this sermon is not unlike the well-worn fable of Stone Soup. Perhaps you remember it. In the story, some travelers come to a village carrying nothing but an empty cooking pot. The travelers arrive amid hard times. Each villager is hoarding a small stash of food, and all of them are hungry. They will not share with each other or with the travelers. The travelers go to a stream, fill up their pot with water, and drop a large stone in it and light a fire underneath it. One of the villagers asks them what they are doing. They reply that they are making stone soup. The soup, they say, tastes wonderful, and they would be delighted to share it with the villager. However, they tell her, it's missing a little something that they need to improve its flavor, to make it a little more savory. Perhaps she would be willing to part with a few carrots. She fetches some from her house, and another curious villager stops at the pot. He asks soup that is stewing. He's convinced to bring a few onions. And so it goes, tomatoes, kale, garlic, eventually come together to make a delicious soup. Individually, there was not enough for anyone to have a meal. Together, the villager and the travelers can eat. A social salvation. After this story and all that I have said, I close with a prayer. May my words, however imperfect, and our time together, however brief, stir us all to remember a greater truth, that we are all caught in the same single garment of destiny. Whatever good there is to be achieved in this world is a good that shall be achieved together. Amen, and blessed be.